We have 10 topics on tap for tonight, so we better get started. So, Alan, take it away.
We have 10 on tap if we can get through them all, right? Okay, so good evening, everyone. And as Chris said, we have a mixed bag tonight. So we'll start off with a follow-up from Chris on old technology.
Yeah, so we were talking last week, May 31st, on various options for getting rid of old tech. It started out with somebody wanting to donate an old printer or a brand new printer, just been sitting in the box, and they didn't want it going into the landfill or anything like that, and they hoped it would go to a charity or some kind of nonprofit. So there were a number of options that were given, things like CompuCore, and then Trash Nothing and e-waste disposal, where you can get rid of old tech stuff, won't necessarily be reused, but or go to a nonprofit, but it may be a way of getting rid of it one way or another. Next. So there were items that were added to the chat window, so that was really good participation in our users helping users. So FreeCycle.org or Kijiji, Craigslist, Facebook groups, HWF Ottawa, and CCI Ottawa. And so those were some other options that were given out. Since then, I came up with another option, and that's National Capital Freenet. And it turns out that they partnered with Valora Tech, which is a registered e-waste recycler. Next. And what you can do is drop off any old electronic items to the NCF offices on Richmond Road. And they say they will take computers, computer parts, modems, routers, printers, monitors, TVs, VCRs. So all kinds of electronics are there. One of the neat things is you can actually specify if you want it to be recycled or reused. And so if you have some stuff that maybe it has sensitive data on it or something like that, you could actually say that you want it to be recycled as opposed to reused or whatever. Next.
I noticed there's an answer to one of the earlier questions there. It says they'll recycle old computer disks.
Old computer disks. Okay. Yeah. Interesting. They pull out one thing in particular. If you have an old modem or a router, that they will go and refurbish it and set it up, and they'll provide it as an affordable modem to other NCF members, so presumably below their retail price for getting a new one. Next. And if you're unsure if they can recycle something, you can contact them. I don't suggest that you actually email to support@ncf.ca. Call them, because I found this information on their website, and I thought websites have a way of collecting old information. It's no longer accurate. And so I emailed support@ncf.ca over a week ago asking if the information was current, and I've yet to hear back from them. So I don't know that you will get any response from support@ncf.ca. So I would suggest if you're interested, give them a call. That's it.
Okay. Thanks, Chris. So next up, we have a question that came in about security alerts that came in over email. And in particular, this was for a PC account, President's Choice, and also the same, similar kind of thing from PayPal. And so the thing was that it gave the correct login information. The email address that was being used was correct. The date and time that the account was accessed were correct. But then it said the device used was Chrome 11 on Windows 10. And the user actually uses Windows 11 and doesn't use Chrome. And then the other thing was it said the location was Etobicoke, which was kind of weird, except it said it's approximate and it can vary if you're on a VPN. But she says, I'm not on a VPN. And the device and location were the same for both alerts. And then, of course, the other thing it says, if it wasn't you, we recommend you change your password. So the user changed her passwords. But the question is, are these genuine alerts? And if they're not, why are they arriving? Well, these kind of things sometimes do occur, especially if you access the same website on different devices. So for example, if you use your Windows computer and then next time you go on with your Android smartphone, at different times, then you may pop up one of these messages. And I have this all the time because I usually go in on Linux, but very occasionally I'll go in over Windows. And so again, it thinks I'm on a different system. But you notice that portion of the message, it said, you recently signed in from a new device. So that's what it's telling you, that you're using different devices on the same account. And it's just warning you that, is this really you, I guess? And the browser, it may not be reporting itself correctly. It may have been Chrome or it may have been something else. And it may not be Windows 10 or 11. The browser doesn't necessarily tell the truth to web servers. And the Etobicoke location is almost certainly the location of the service provider's web server, rather than being the location of the computer, which is in Ottawa, clearly. And I have this all the time. Websites think I live in Toronto or somewhere because my Bell server is clearly based out there somewhere. Now, sometimes, as well as getting the alert, you get a message that says, is this you? And it wants confirmation. So a couple of examples here. Here's me signing into Google. And again, generally I use Linux, but this time I use Windows. So it's just saying, hey, is this you? If it's you, then you don't need to do anything. And if not, we'll help you to secure your account. Well, I know it's me, so I'm not concerned. But then this one is me trying to log into Dropbox in the same kind of way. And now it's asking, is this you? And it's giving me choices, yes or no, or I'm not sure. If I hit yes, then it says, oh, yeah, that is you. And everybody's happy. And they are genuine warnings, and that's all they are. They're just warnings. I see Stuart says he uses the Brave browser. And President's Choice always sends him alerts. And he's randomly located all over Ontario and Quebec. You shouldn't travel around so much, Stu. Okay, I think that's it for that item. So moving along, Karen was asking about YouTube. And she says, well, a lot of members must use YouTube and you have things that are really good. What would you recommend? And so I asked the last Q&A, or suggestions for technical-based items, I mean, computer-based stuff. You don't want all the other junk that's on YouTube necessarily. So we got a few things came in. I would start off with one of my favorites is Chris Barnett on Explaining Computers. And he has weekly videos. He posts a new video every Sunday. And it's typically about new hardware, building or upgrading hardware items. He talks quite a bit about Linux mainly, sometimes other OSs, and a lot of stuff on single board computers. So if you're interested in single board computers, not just necessarily Raspberry Pi, but all kinds of different SBCs, and he has a lot of information on reviews and uses and that kind of thing. And he also has some other topics like RISC-V, CPUs, and quantum computers. And I really like him. He's English, and he has a really droll sense of humor with Stanley the Knife and Mr. Scissors. And he has some really good, I think he has some really good videos. And one of the latest ones, I think this was 2 weeks ago, he had this video on explaining Wi-Fi 802.11. It's really good how he goes through the history of these Wi-Fi standards and what they do and how they change over time. Okay, next up we have a series of YouTube videos which Chris pointed out, something in 100 seconds. And the example here is C, the programming language C in 100 seconds, or I actually like this one, Python in 100 seconds. And the one that Chris suggested, there's maybe a share on this Q&A session, was Linux directories explained in 100 seconds. And if you're interested in the Linux file system, it really is a very good video and in that short time frame. But Linux file systems are pretty complex, so I don't think they're for everyone. If you have any interest, then this is a really good series on all kinds of different operating systems and computer features and stuff. And another one, this one actually came about from Joss Dwar. He mentioned a video on how the guy who, no, sorry, that's wrong. I actually came across this one when I was looking at something else, and I found this where grep came from. And it says grep was written overnight, but why and how did it get its name? It's how it got its name is really quite interesting. It turns out it wasn't actually written overnight. It was debugged overnight and then handed off to somebody at Bell Labs. But it's really good in terms of there are some pretty in-depth reviews on programming languages like C, how the Tor browser works, and an item here on the Holy Grail of artificial intelligence, how to choose a password, more on computer quantum computing, and stuff on blockchains and bitcoins. So there's a whole raft of pretty technical stuff there. Again, if you're interested, it's worth looking through. Now, this is the one that came about from Jocelyn Dwar. He pointed out that this guy is a Microsoft engineer, a retired Microsoft engineer, who actually wrote the first version of Task Manager. And there's a video on how Task Manager started off and how it developed and it's how you can use it. And it's really quite interesting. And he has a lot of different items on various aspects of Windows and tutorials, and it's pretty wide ranging. So again, a lot of things there worth a look. And Stuart suggested a couple. This one is called Long Reviews Tech Channel, and it's "I try before you buy" is his tagline. So it's somebody who's really interested in electronics, and he reviews all kinds of things, mostly. And Stuart says he's the most unbiased, independent, general tech reviewer he's found. So that's a good recommendation for long reviews. And the second one Stuart suggested was called Mr. Mobile. And this is essentially a set of videos, YouTube videos again, on smartphones and those kind of gadgets. And Michael Fisher is the presenter. He says he's a writer, sailor, podcaster, recovering actor whose childhood obsession with science fiction never quite faded. There again. So those are the ones I have so far. If anybody has any other YouTube favorites in the technical realm, then please tell us about them. Okay, anything else on that, Chris?
Nope.
Okay, so moving along then, we have a presentation from Bob Walker, who's going to share his screen, and he has a tale of three laptops. So take it away, Bob.
Okay, I'm just trying to get the share going here, and there we go. Okay, I started this out because I had a problem with an HP Hewlett-Packard Envy laptop, and this problem applies to also the Hewlett-Packard Pavilion laptops and several other laptop models, and I knew that Hewlett-Packard laptops are quite popular, and several of the members may have one or are considering buying one. So this story covers three similar laptops purchased over a five-year period and shows support issues by all three manufacturers. All of them had a 14 or 15-inch touchscreen, a 500 or 1 terabyte solid-state drive, 10 or 12 megs of memory, and a backlit keyboard. The first one I'm going to look at is a Lenovo Flex laptop. I bought this in 2015 directly from the Lenovo Canada website because they had a really good special on, including a special on the guaranteed 2 business day on-site service warranty. When the unit died after 9 months, the 2-day business on-site service ended up being 2 weeks. The on-site guy wasn't a Lenovo employee. He was a contractor that works for several companies, so he had no particular training on Lenovo laptops. And so he couldn't fix the problem. But he did, while he was working out, his screwdriver slipped. He put a big scratch across the keyboard. So the computer had to be sent to Lenovo Repair Depot where they diagnosed a dead video card. They didn't have any spares for this in stock. After 3 months of waiting for the part to come from China and with no end date in sight, I bought another laptop, an Acer Aspire. And over a month later, I finally got the Lenovo laptop back. They had also replaced the keyboard that their repair contractor had scratched. I sold this computer to a friend, and 3 years later, the solid-state drive failed and cost him over $400 to get fixed. So this laptop wasn't particularly reliable, and their service was left a lot to be desired. Now, I have had several Lenovo ThinkPads over the years, and so I was quite disappointed in this. The next one was an Acer Aspire. I bought this in 2016 from Best Buy to replace the missing in action Lenovo. It worked okay until the original Windows 10 Creators update killed the Bluetooth. And this problem also affected an Asus Transformer laptop I had. Acer support was aware of this issue affecting many of their laptops, but they had no fixes for it, and their attitude was sort of a shrug of their shoulders type of thing, like, meh. I tried all sorts of fixes I found online, but they didn't get me anywhere, and none of the following Microsoft updates and patches fix a problem either. So I put it away when I bought the Hewlett-Packard Envy laptop to replace it. When I had to use the Acer Aspire again while the Hewlett-Packard was being repaired, I wiped it clean and did a fresh install of Windows 10. And the Bluetooth now sort of works sometimes. Especially disappointing is the screen casting to my TV still doesn't work. But the overall performance of the laptop is somewhat slow. While the Hewlett-Packard Envy is thin and lightweight, the Acer is thick and heavy. Now, this doesn't matter. I don't lug it around much. It's mainly for use at home. And the screen resolution is okay, but the picture quality is mediocre. And you notice on a lot of laptops, if you get off access to the screen, the screen fades away a bit. This laptop is particularly sensitive to this. So you don't need to get off access by more than a few degrees for the screen to start to fade out. That said, I did this presentation on this while the Hewlett-Packard was being fixed for the third time. The Hewlett-Packard Envy laptop, I bought this in 2020, from Costco, and, I also bought their Excellence Plus, 3-year warranty. It was $99, which seemed a bit expensive, but it was money that turned out to be very well spent. This was at this time, it was 6 months into the COVID crisis, when getting a laptop, a webcam, router, smartphones, or anything else like that was very hard due to the all the people suddenly having to work from home and get the appropriate equipment. Just a note here that Costco doubles the manufacturer's warranty on most electronics, including TVs and computers, at no charge. So I didn't actually have to spring for their extra warranty. The good things about this laptop are the screen has a great picture. None of this off-axis nonsense. You can get well off to the side or whatever before the screen starts to fade away. It has a Bang & Olufsen sound system that gives awesome sound for a laptop. The solid state drive, the memory, and the AMD Ryzen processor gives it good performance. And note that this is the only computer I've ever owned that doesn't have an Intel processor. So I'm pleasantly surprised at the performance. And it's Windows 11 compatible. The bad, despite following the directions in the user guide, the maintenance and service guide, as well as all the latest directions from HP online, I can't get into the BIOS setup mode to change any of the settings. The fan is very noisy, and I found out this problem noted in several reviews. The backlighting on the keyboard times out in a few seconds, even when it's plugged in. So if you pause to think about something in a dimly lit room, the keyboard lights go out, which is very annoying. So I've gotten very good at pressing the finding the control or the shift keys to bring the lights back on so I can continue my work. One of the USB ports on the left side has a little flap thing, and when you have something plugged into the port, the flap sticks down, and if you move the laptop around at all, it'll scratch the table. And there's rubbery strips along the bottom instead of feet, and they're sort of a silicone material. They won't stay stuck onto the bottom, so I had to stick them on with some 1-inch wide Scotch tape. The ugly is what triggered me to write this whole presentation. The hinges between the screen and the keyboard have broken three times, and despite the laptop being treated very carefully, and I treated especially carefully after the first hinge breakage. And note that although it has this capability, I never folded the screen back into tablet mode. Now, I found out in doing some research a few weeks ago that the hinges of HP Envy and Pavilion laptops are apparently a weak point, and I'll talk more about this in a minute. That said, Costco's concierge warranty service has fixed it free each time. But their warranty runs out in a few months, and I'll be on the hook after that to fix the hinges if they break again.
Well, Tom Trottier has a question about the warranty. How long is the warranty from when you bought the machine?
3 years.
Okay.
And I'll talk a bit more about that in a minute. So I did some research online after the hinge broke for the third time, and apparently the hinges on Hewlett-Packard Envy, Envy 360, Pavilion, Pavilion 360, and several other laptop models sold during or after 2017 are defectively designed and can break after only a few months of use. And note that some of these laptops, especially the ones with the 360 designation, you can fold the screen backwards into tablet mode. The defect is caused by Hewlett-Packard's decision to anchor the device's hinges in poorly designed, flimsy plastic parts of the case. And so opening and closing the laptops in the course of ordinary use can cause yankers to separate from the device because the plastic around them breaks and snap, otherwise fail. And this renders the computers useless as a laptop. You can't open and close a screen very easily after that.
Bob, Tom's suggesting that you could possibly lubricate the hinges with graphite powder.
It's hard to get into them the way they're designed, unless you like disassemble the thing. And there's a few pictures here showing the way things mount, and the way that the tapped inserts are surrounded by very thin plastic. Now, depending on the various reports I read online, either Hewlett-Packard will fix the hinges, no questions asked, under warranty, but after that you'll be left paying for any repairs yourself, or in a lot of cases, HP claims the hinge breakage is a result of abuse and they force you to pay for any repairs yourself. This problem has been ongoing since 2017, and apparently Hewlett-Packard has yet to fix the design of this, so any current laptops of the models mentioned still have this problem. There was a class action lawsuit in the U.S. It was dismissed when HP decided it was cheaper to settle out of court with the original complainant than to lose the lawsuit and have to reimburse customers hundreds of dollars. For more information on the hinge issue, there's a URL there, or you can just Google HP Envy hinge issues, and you get all pages and pages of stuff. That said, there's videos on YouTube that show you how to fix the hinge problems yourself if you're stuck having to pay for it out of warranty. Now, over the years, between my own personal laptops, my family's laptops, my work laptops, and all the laptops used by my staff and colleagues at work, as well as a lot of my friends at OPCUG, I've never heard of a broken hinge before. That said as well is Hewlett-Packard doesn't have a great reputation for supporting their products, especially the older ones. You know, just try and find a Hewlett-Packard driver for an older printer. That said, they're still happy to sell you the overpriced ink for the old printers. Overall, the product support from Hewlett-Packard, Acer, and Lenovo was somewhat disappointing. The service from Costco's concierge warranty service has been awesome, especially considering the relatively low initial cost of the warranty, and it's a 3-year warranty. Basically, I phone them up, give them my order number. They FedEx me a special packing box with a prepaid label, shipping label. I get that within 1 or 2 business days. I pack it up, put the labels on, drop it off at the local UPS or FedEx depot in Kempville. And I get it back within 4 or 5 working days. And also keep in mind that if you don't want to pay for the extra warranty, Costco already doubles the manufacturer's warranty on most electronics at no extra cost. And that's it for today.
So Tom had a pretty draconian possible fix for you. He says, possibly fill around the plastic with epoxy.
Well, no. When I looked in the picture, it looked like
the screws were kind of in at the corners of some plastic part that was hollow. And if I'm just thinking, if you fill in the hollow parts, it might be more sturdy. Now, especially after it's out of warranty.
Well, if the hinge breaks again once it's out of warranty, I'm just going to put it together with a couple of door hinges. And I, you know, who cares about the looks? Because right now it's, I do most of my computing sitting in my lazy boy in the living room. And so I open and close it a fair amount. And so I can't use the Hewlett-Packard for that really anymore, because repeated use is going to break the damn hinge again. So I use the old Acer Aspire there in the living room, and the Hewlett-Packard sits on my desk in my office to use for anything I can take the time to go into the office and do, which is sort of annoying. I keep my current work on a little USB stick and move it back and forth between the two computers. So it's a real pain. And despite the picture quality and the sound quality and the other great features of the Hewlett-Packard, it's overall been a big disappointment to me.
Okay, thanks, Bob. Better luck next time, I guess. Okay, our next item is a question that came in about Windows subsystem for Linux. Is it better or worse than dual booting or using a virtual machine? And I posted this on the website and nobody had any bright ideas, except Bob's friend says it's WSL is basically a compatibility layer that enables running Linux distros natively on Windows. And it leverages the power of both Windows and Linux simultaneously. And to flush that out a bit, it says that you can use it as a development environment. So it will run a lot of Linux utilities, command line tools and scripts. And you can run Linux commands and scripts on your Windows box. And for web development, it supports tools like Node.js and Ruby and Python, PHP. And these all have better support and performance on Linux rather than Windows, it says. And developers can use it to make sure that their programs are compatible, Linux programs with Windows. And one of the things everybody can use it for is to learn Linux. So you can actually use your Windows machine and experiment with Linux at the same time. And then for really obscure things, containerization, things like Docker, and you can use Windows System for Linux to run Linux containers on Windows. So if you have any of those needs, then that's a reason you might want to use WSL. I asked it, well, is it better or worse than dual booting or using a virtual machine? It says, well, it depends on your needs. It's like one of these, it depends, right? They say it's convenient. You can seamlessly switch between Windows and Linux. You don't have to reboot if you think of like a dual boot machine. You can only run one OS at once. With this one, you can run both at once and just switch between them. And you get comparable performance than virtual machines, or perhaps even better sometimes. And you can run Linux without doing a separate installation or running a virtual machine. And in terms of isolation, WSL isn't quite as good as a virtual machine because the VM will give you a higher level of isolation. But it's good for resources. It generally runs in fewer risk system resources than running a full virtual machine. But for things like special needs, like graphic card acceleration, low-level access to the hardware, or specific features of the kernel, then either dual booting or using a virtual machine may be more suitable. So that's the it depends kind of thing. And if you remember that guy from Microsoft, Dave Plummer, he actually has this video. It's really good. I didn't know anything about Windows Subsystem for Linux because I have real Windows and I have real Linux. I'm happy to dual boot into Windows when I really need to. He has this video here called Windows and Linux Together at Last. And basically he points out that what you really have with Windows Subsystem for Linux is you have Windows and Linux each running in kind of virtual machines, and they're both talking to the same hardware through the hypervisor layer. And apparently that is really quite efficient. So he recommends that as a way to go. So if you have any interest in Windows System for Linux, then there's some information and a video to watch for more.
And just before you go on, for anybody who missed it, I guess I just picked up on it, and so maybe some other people are as dumb as me about it. When Alan referred to Bob's friend, I presume you're talking about ChatGPT.
That was ChatGPT, yes.
Yeah, okay.
And all else fails, consult ChatGPT.
Okay.
As I said, I didn't know anything about WSL, so I thought Bob's always promoting the idea of AI being really good for things. And sure enough, it just chapter and verse there. And it all sounds quite reasonable. I mean, I don't know much about it, but the information sounded quite practical and correct. Anyway, the next question Tom had was, which free virtual machine manager is recommended? Do we recommend one for Linux and Windows? Well, this is kind of a no-brainer right now because I just wrote an article in the newsletter on using VirtualBox. VirtualBox will run in both systems, and you can load the other operating system of your choice as a guest operating system. VirtualBox is really the only VM program I've used. It works really quite well. It's got a lot better over time. And if you want to try it, the good news is it's free. And if you don't like it, you can just delete it, uninstall it, and try something else. Now, in the past, people here have tried other things. Chris had an article in the newsletter a while ago about VMware. And he said he just had to find out. And I think he found out that it worked quite well.
That does date back quite a bit. As I said in the lead into the article, I was running Windows 2000 for over a year.
Yeah, 2001, you had a presentation on VMware at one of these members' favorites deal. And in 2015, we had somebody who came from VMware Canada and gave a presentation on virtualization, but unfortunately, he didn't leave us his deck, so there's nothing to follow up there. But then in 2016, Jeff Dubois also presented on VMware. But again, there's no deck from that presentation. But if you're interested in VMware, it's still available, and there's a free version. And here's the URL which will take you there. And if you're interested in something else, then if you do a Google search for virtual machine software, you'll come across this item, which is a list of VM software for the current year. It includes VMware, it includes VirtualBox. Parallels Desktop isn't really applicable to us because that's an Apple device. If you're in the open source freeware world, you might have heard of QEMU, and then there's Citrix Hypervisor. Zen Project is another open source type thing, and Microsoft Hypervisor is a possibility. So there's some options for anybody who's interested in running virtual machines on either Windows or Linux. So now we're going to move on, and Chris has got some information about file history.
Yeah, we had some question, a recommendation on how to set up and what you should change from the defaults or leave as the defaults in file history. So just to recap on it, file history is built into Windows since Windows 8, and it provides two things, really. So you have near real-time backup, of important. I say mostly data because really its focus is on files that you're going to be modifying on an ongoing basis. So it can be as frequently as every 10 minutes that it will back up any changed files. And it gives you easy versioning of the files so that you can get back potentially years worth of versions of your data files that you're editing if you need to go back to a previous version. Next. So it's not a substitute for an image backup of your complete computer. I highly, highly recommend that people do that. Image backup gives you much easier disaster recovery. You don't have to reinstall the operating system, reinstall your applications, and then get your data back. You can bring it all back in one fell swoop. Next. It's not a substitute for offsite backup, in particular an image backup that is stored offsite, which can give you protection against things like fire and flood and things like that. Next. All three are actually recommended, and they work together to provide a very comprehensive ability to recover anything that you might lose due to anything. Next. Okay, so previous file history information. If you're new to file history, I recommend checking out that article. I pasted the URLs into the chat. It gives a good overview on how to actually set up and use file history. Next. Some other ones that we've had a Q&A, tweaking file history, upgrading it to a new computer, and how to fix it when it's broken. Next. And then I had a rant on February 22nd of this year on Windows 11 and file history. Next. So the defaults for file history, backing up newer changed files, the default is every hour. There are many options from every 10 minutes to daily, and they have 10, 20 minutes, I think 30 minutes, 1 hour, 2 hour, 4 hour, so forth up to daily. I recommend that you look at it as frequently, do it fairly frequently so that you have the best in terms of near real-time protection. So if you have a crash or if you have, you go and mess up a file and you save it, you can go back and get something that is not too old to get back to working state. So keep how long backups are kept. The default is forever, which I think is a real mistake. There are options from anywhere from between 1 month and 2 years, or until space is required, as well as the default of forever. Choose anything but forever. If you choose forever, eventually the drive you use for file history backups will fill up, and you will actually have to manually go in and do a cleanup on it. Now, manually, it's a menu option, but you have to actually go in and say that you want to delete some of your file history. So I recommend look at it probably anywhere 6 months or a year or something like that. For most people, it's probably appropriate, but don't leave it up forever. Next.
Do you know, Chris, if it warns you before it's going to quit, or does it just stop?
I don't actually know because I've never left it on forever. because I saw it and I was horrified by the fact that they would actually let it go, on that as an option. So I'm really not sure. Then you have folders that you want to back up, and file history is based on folders. So it will back up everything in a folder and all subfolders as opposed to specifying files. There is a long list that includes documents, pictures, downloads, desktop music. Then there are some anecdotal evidence that some people have it default to some folders in the public profile, the OneDrive folder, your app data roaming folder as well. And so you really do have to go in and make some choices on that. So the options are any files, any of the folders that you want. And keep in mind that through this presentation today, I'm only talking about Windows 10. So what do I recommend for folders to back up? Well, it really is complicated. Next. So the Microsoft Answers Forum, somebody posed the question, which directories does file history back up? And the answer verbatim here is it will be set to back up important. That's my bolding on it. I don't know how anybody would determine what's important to me. Important folders in the user's account home folder, and it includes, which implies that maybe there's some other stuff as well, desktop documents, downloads, music, pictures, videos, folders, and it also includes the roaming folder where many of the programs store application data. That's a hidden folder, by the way. Most people, you don't want to go in messing around in the roaming folder. Your OneDrive folder, which I don't know why you would want to back that up. You already have it backed up in the cloud. You can recover from that, and there is version control in that. Limited, but it's there. And they say other folders. What that means, God only knows. Next. So, why do I have this again? This was the response to it. Yes. Okay. So the person who originally asked the question responded, said, I read the marketing stuff, help pages on file history, and it's far from clear, exactly what is being chosen. The list you, whoever it was that gave that answer, I don't think it was a Microsoft employee, and the marketing material, quote, is far from definitive and does not agree with what I see in practice. So even on the Microsoft Answers Forum, it's complicated. Next. So what do I recommend? Include only the default folders where your important data files are stored. So folders containing files that you want near real-time backup. So you're editing them on an ongoing basis. And as you save them, you want to have it that if you accidentally make some changes and save it, you'll be able to get back another version of it prior to the save. And you want version history so you can recover old versions of your files. Next.
I would guess an important point there, Chris, is that you have to know where your data files are being stored.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, for the most part, it actually is not too bad, because if you think about when the files that you are editing are the ones that you're most critically wanting to be covered by file history, so that if you accidentally make an editing change and save it, you can go back and get a previous version of it. So you know the files that you're actively working on and saving, presumably. But there are some exceptions.
Yeah, if you don't change anything in Windows, it's likely that they're going to be in documents, pictures, and videos.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But not necessarily just that.
No. That's a good point, yes. So I would suggest you remove some of the default folders that don't meet the above criteria, and you'll probably find there are a lot that you do not store files in that you need to have backups of outside of just your normal backup regimen. Next. And then add in folders meeting the criteria not included by default. So if you have, say, you're storing data files on a D drive or something else, then you can include those extra folders in with that. Next. So. This is on my laptop computer. This is the default list of folders. And I had to actually go down to a really small font on the screen in order to capture all of this in one list. So next, take a look at some of it. So the ones highlighted now are all related to OneDrive. Well, I don't use OneDrive, so I don't care about backing up those particular folders. Next. A whole bunch of folders where I don't need these. So, you know, you look at some of them, 3D objects. I don't know what the heck that's all about at all. Searches, utils, .NET, or actually .NET, .Android, things like that. You look down at the bottom, the music folder. I mean, I'm not changing my music files. So I put it there. It gets backed up by my normal backup regimen. I'm not going to edit a music file and save over top of it and go, oh, I got to go and get, you know, back a previous version. So I'll remove all of those from being backed up. Next. And then I have one here, downloads. Well, some people might want to actually include downloads. Some people not. I use it as an ongoing storage space. So maybe I want that, you know, if I delete a file after a couple of days, it's in the download, and then I decide I want it back. Rather than going trying to find where I got it from in the original, I might, you know, want to pick it up from file history. So that's an example of a sort of file that, or a folder that it depends. You know, you got to assess it on your own needs. Next. So what am I left with? I'm left with My Drive, which is the Google Drive folder, pictures and documents, and that's it. So that's really all the files that I actually want to be backed up by file history. Next. So if you happen to see something that looks like C:\users\your user ID\app data, you might want to actually remove that. The app data folder is huge. I think on my desktop computer is something like 35 gigabytes of files in app data. And it's probably going to include nothing that you actually want to go in and be able to recover through file history. So take serious consideration on that if you see app data included in the list. Next. I didn't, on any of my computers, I've never seen app data included by default, but some other people say it was there. So next week, you're going to be treated to or inflicted with another one of my rants, and it is going to be about file history in Windows 11. Next. And I'll give you a hint right up front. It's a mess. Next. And it's going to get worse. So stay tuned. That's it for file history.
Can't wait for next week.
Yeah.
Okay. I put a note in the chat. We're in the last 10 minutes, but I haven't seen any questions in the chat. So if anybody has any other questions that they desperately want answered this week, you put something in the chat, we'll try to get back to them. But in the meantime, we're just going to have a couple of Stuart's Loony Bits. You remember these are Canadian websites that Stuart and other people, I guess, finds useful. So, Stuart, you want to talk about these two things?
Well, I can try. Gee, who wrote this stuff? I'm telling you, the guy, the license he takes for the English language. I found this website really handy because it's a regional website, and I am so tired of going to the CBC or CTV or any of the major news outlets. And, you know, they only really talk about Ottawa, Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver, Calgary, and the rest of the world outside our borders. If you're displaced from the Maritimes, here is something for you. Saltwire.com gives you all the news of Newfoundland and Labrador that you could ever want. It's refreshing. You know, there's no mention of rent prices in Montreal or those arseholes in Ottawa and what they're doing to us. It's about local news in a region of Canada that's largely ignored by the major outlets. And if any of you happen to have passed through it, you might even know some of the places and people they're talking about. I have a fondness for a certain spot in Halifax that I will not discuss in public. But that's not Newfoundland. Anyway, saltwire.com, Newfoundland and Labrador. Get your local news from down east there. There's another one, isn't there? Oh, yes. And closer to home for you guys, inside the Ottawa Valley. There's a lot of local news west of the Ottawa area. And this website gives it to you. And I don't know what the Ottawa Citizen delivers anymore. It's been a long time since I've actually read a copy of it. But whenever I did look at it, it didn't get into any of the details that that this particular website does. It covers most of the local small cities and towns. And, you know, given that half the people that are living in Ottawa are actually from somewhere else, usually in the valley or further away, this website can really remind you of what's going on back home. Now, who wrote the second line? Recall the nuances of the Ottawa Valley Brogue. Alan.
Hey.
Hey. Oh, my gosh. G'day, mate.
Okay.
The Ottawa Valley's got strong similarities to Australian accent. Anyway, those are two regional websites that discuss areas that you won't find in the major news websites. If anybody knows of anything else around the country that doesn't talk about the major cities and the issues going on in there. Well, hey, jump really in and share them with us.
You'll be really disappointed in Tom's offering then. He's got a loony link here. Ottawa air quality forecast.
Why, did he fart?
I guess it's your smoke coming down to keep us up. Okay, thanks, Stuart. We'll see if anybody has any other loony links, and we'll listen for your next offering with bated breath.
Bated.
A question came in late today from Glenn. He uses Fongo for making VoIP calls for free when he's traveling, but sometimes Fongo is unavailable. And his question really is, does Fongo Plus, which is $10 a month basically, does that improve the reliability of Fongo, or does it just add U.S. calling and so forth, and the reliability is just the same as for the free service? And he only needs occasional service for 3 months. And can anybody recommend an inexpensive, more reliable month-to-month service? So if anybody has any bright ideas, then let us know. Bob Walker provided two suggestions, possibly Skype and WhatsApp. And I checked on Skype, but as far as I can tell, it's not free. You have to buy airtime credits to call people. But WhatsApp, of course, is free, and it's actually a really neat application. You can use essentially like a smart, simple messaging service, SMS type messages. You can actually make telephone calls, like voice calls, but you can also do video conferences. Now, I think the only caveat is the person on the other end still also has to have WhatsApp. But it's really quite good for that kind of thing otherwise.
That's also true with Skype.
Somebody's trying to say something.
Yes, it's also
Tom, true. You're quiet.
Can you hear me now? No?
No, still quiet. You're muted now. You're not muted.
Can you hear me now?
No.
Barely.
Shout out and we'll hear you.
We have a note from Stu. Sugar Mobile is a low-cost MVNO. That might help. So that's one possible recommendation.
I was just trying to say that Skype
works a little the way that WhatsApp does. You can Skype to other Skype users. Just like with WhatsApp, you have to connect to another WhatsApp user.
Okay, good. Thank you. Okay, well, we're just about the witching hour, so I think we might just skip the final item and try to go to that one, which was any other questions, which there weren't any in the chat. So if anybody has anything terribly urgent, you can open your mic and tell us. And while you're thinking about that, I'll just remind you that our next Q&A session will be next Wednesday, June the 28th, and as usual, if you have questions or topics you'd like to share, loony links to add to Stu's, YouTube favorites to add to Karen's, send us a note to suggestion box, and we'll add it to next week's deck. Other than that, I think we're about at the end of our scheduled hour, so hopefully we'll see you all next week.
Thanks, folks.